Sunday, January 28th, 2018, and I say Shavuot Tov Mevorach to those in front of me and to those listening across the world. Nisha Gadola died last week, either Wednesday, Thursday. I think the funeral was Thursday morning. And I want to dedicate the Shiur in her memory. Toby Willick, you recognize the name Willick. This is the famous rabbi. It's his aunt, exactly. She was married to his father's brother, Herb, who was an MTA graduate in 1940. Her late husband, who I knew quite well, also knew Rabbi Revel. He came into the yeshiva when it was still in its early stages. And Toby was a powerhouse. I nicknamed her the blonde. The blonde bombshell. That's the word I named her. She had a blonde wig, and she was an activist, president of Amuna, but much more than that, believed what we all believe in: Eretz Yisrael, Lam Yisrael, Apitorat Yisrael, with no compromises. She constantly wrote letters to the Jerusalem Post, and she was a very special lady, and we will miss her. Mark and I were quite close to her and her late husband. Her daughter was my student in Machon Gold, 71-72, and I knew her sons, Joey and David. David needs a refuah shlema. The story is a human being, remains a human being. He went to America to do kashrut before Pesach. He went for a few months and he made enough money to live here the rest of the year. And he fell off a ladder. I think it was in a shlachtos or something. And he's been a vegetable ever since. Okay. The only good part of it is that the place where he was working in Hashgacha was very well insured, so they take care of him. He's in a hospice for a long time already, but it's very sad. But he should have refuah shlema, and Toby should be a good debater for Unz and Al Klal Yisrael. And the Dafka, what we're going to hit upon today, is something that I always spoke with Toby about. So I want to dedicate this year in her memory. I want to say I was very moved. Yitzchak brought in copies of his notes on the Hesbedan of Chaim Heller, the Hesbedan of the Briska Rav.
I want your notes.
And very nice. And a talk that Rabbi Joseph Lukstein gave, I gather. You have here, it's cut off with the... Rabbi Yisrael once said, it is easier for a rabbi to be a Jew than it is for a merchant. And do you know what Rabbi Yisrael meant by that? That the rabbi, so what is he involved with? Shabbat, Kashrut, no big deal. A merchant is involved with Choshen Mishpat. And how many of us pay attention to be proper Jews when it comes to Choshen Mishpat?
But these notes were when I was a young man.
Right, I understand. You were a kid at the time. And here you're writing notes in English. The Rebbe is speaking in Yiddish. You're writing it in English, and you're trying to take everything down. I don't say the notes are as good as what was later published in the Rebbe's manuscript.
What's the name? Were they both a book?
It's Conspectus of the Rebbe.
Conspectus is much better.
Well, okay. Did I ever tell you my son just did a Siyum Choshen Mishpat at Eretz Tender?
Very nice, very nice. All right, he can be a Dayan if he knows
Choshen.
If he knows Choshen Mishpat and Neven Esen,
he
can be a Dayan. But I had a Yetzer Hara but I have to remain a Rebbe. Okay, let's come back here. Now, we spoke about last week was a very important shiur. How the Rav made this journey from Agudat Yisrael to the Mizrahi, and in a way it teaches us that one doesn't have to be ashamed to change his opinion. And you always have to evaluate what is correct, what is not correct. I've said over from the Rav much divrei Torah on the topic. But I want to talk about a moment in the Rav's life, and here I have to thank Ayesh Sklar. He asked me a question last week that opened my mind and resulted in an unbelievable material which I will present this morning. I don't think this material has ever been spoken about in public before, and I consider today's share epic making and understanding the Rav. But let's begin at the beginning. We leave our house, we never know what's going to happen. When I look back on my life, you can ask me, 100 years from now, ask me, tell me what happened that was so important in your life? And you know what happened? Someone in Queens started making copies of my shiurim that reached a few of my talmidim in America when they were cassettes. And unknown to me, he was selling them and people were buying and people got to know me through the cassettes. And out of that connection comes something that's epic making that we'll talk about 100 years from now, Be'ezrat Hashem. Fine. But what I'm trying to say is you never know, something's happening to you. It's just another ordinary day. You woke up, you went to shul, you davened, you ate breakfast, you learned the Daf Gemara. It was just another day like every other day so far in your mature life. And you can never tell what moment becomes the moment, Shein Lecha Adam, Shein Lo Sha'ab, Pirkei Avot, where you hit a Grand Slam home run that affects tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, affects all of subsequent Torah history. 1956, the 8th anniversary of the State of Israel. And by the way, if you would have told many of the people on the street, Jewish people in America, Canada, England, South Africa, today's the 8th anniversary of the Jewish state, where will you be when the state turns 70? People would look at you, what are you, crazy? The state won't survive. It's impossible. You know, people still couldn't believe the state was a reality. By this time, the Rav had become a full-fledged Mizrahiite, and it's not just you become a Mizrahiite in thinking, but his commitment was there. There wasn't a Mizrahi convention where he was not the keynote speaker. You follow, this was his life. This is where he threw his hat in, where he participated, where he joined, where he felt at ease. These was Chaverim. And they evidently asked the Rav, who was in the prime of his life at the time, and strength, and they asked him, Rebbe, give a talk. It's the 8th anniversary of the State of Israel. Give a talk. And the Rav gave the talk. It was given at Yeshiva University in the auditorium, Lamport Auditorium, named after Mr. Nathan Lamport, one of the three who gave $200,000 to the yeshiva in the 1920s. And he gave a talk. Lamport Auditorium was filled. Among the hundreds there was a kid named Donnie Rothkopf and his girlfriend from Ramaz named Malka. And the Rav gave a talk. I don't know when he prepared that talk. I don't know if he realized the implications. Now, I'm not going to redo the talk. I'll just refer to the two main parts which captivated the world. The Rav spoke about fate and destiny. That's the way they translated into English. By the way, there have been two English translations done of the talk. The manuscript, the Rav's manuscript, was in Hebrew. He later published it in Hadoah, I believe, was the first place where it was published. He spoke about that last week. And he gave the talk in Yiddish, and over the course of the next 40, 50 years, there were two translations done of the talk into Hebrew. I believe one is by Larry Kaplan, one is by Dr. Gordon. They're both equally good, equally insightful. And the Rav spoke about the fact that a man, there's Goral and there's Yehud. His command of Hebrew is magnificent. The Rav had a knack with languages. Yiddish, of course, he was. Ein maladaber, no one came near him. But even in English and in Hebrew, his command was overwhelming. So the Rav spoke about the challenge to us to change our Goral into a Yehud, to change our fate into a destiny. And essentially what the Rav was saying was we Jews have gone through a lot, up and down, down and out, challenges, torture, death, sacrifice, holiness, learning, and to take all of Jewish faith and turn it into our destiny, that we can change the world, change the Jewish world, build the State of Israel, reunite with God, with Torah. And then the Rav spoke, of course, the most famous part of the talk, the Sheish Tzvikot, that God is knocking at our door. And he took Shir HaShirim. And in a well-known Shir HaShirim, you can view Shir HaShirim on many levels. But don't forget, Ein HaMikra Yotzei Midei Pshata, Pshuta. What the Torah talks about, what Shir HaShirim, what Nach talks about, what Ketuvim talk about, there's the simple pshat. You can build on it, but the simple pshat is most important. And it's talking about, and I have to tell you, I've seen this in life with my students 1,000 times over. It's part of life. A boy and a girl, they're in love, and factors come up in life, and the boy comes running to the girl, and he's knocking on her door, and he wants to see her, wants to formulate their future. And I'm quoting from Shir HaShirim, and the Doda answers, Pashantati et kutati echa al bishena. I've taken off my clothes, I'm ready to go to sleep, how can I get dressed again? Come back another time. And the Dod goes away, and the next morning she realizes, where is he? He hasn't come back. And she's looking for him and looking for him, and she doesn't find him. Ultimately, only be a Mot HaMashiach. And that Shir HaShirim, the love affair between God and the Jews and Matan Torah and we sin, and we don't open the door, and opportunity is knocking. Kol Dodi Dofei, Kol Dodi Dofei, and Pashandati Et Kuntatai Echa Al Bishera. And the Rav took that and he said, God is knocking at our door. Look at the miracles that we have gone through. And he lists out 6 different miracles, among them the founding of the state, that every Jew has a place to go. Kibbutz Goliath, compare that to the white paper, all that went on under the British. This is why all my grandchildren already saw, want to see The Dark Hour. Everyone's talking about the Churchill movie, and I tell them, on one hand I'm moved, but on the other hand I think, just as Roosevelt, if you've seen the movie, Roosevelt tells them to go fly a kite, he told the Jewish people to go fly a kite, the English government. How many more Jews could have been saved had the doors here been open? So look at the miracle. We now have a state, it's open, we have an army. Until now, Dam Yehudi, I'm quoting the Rav, was Hefka. You could do whatever you want to the Jew, he couldn't fight back. And now we have an army. And he goes on and on in the miracles that we see, that God is knocking at our door. The Rav makes a statement. I heard this with my own ears. I remember I was shaking when I heard it. I was a kid. How old was I in 56? But those are the formative years. I was already in the college. I was in Yeshiva College. And the Rav says, in my opinion, we have a tremendous miracle in the UN. He said, the UN, Russia and America never voted the same position. And when it came to recognizing the state of Israel, Russia and America voted the same position. And he said, this too, he felt the whole UN was only established to recognize the state of Israel. Follow, like people are saying about Trump's election, look how Trump was elected against all odds, and look what it's done for the state of Israel, Yerushalayim, the Jewish people, Mike Pence, Nikki Haley, etc., etc. So, I'll never forget the Rav speaking, he went on and on, Catholic theology, Kol Dodi Dofeik, look at the miracle. Until now, the Catholic Church, which was a bitter enemy of the Jewish people, don't measure the Catholic Church by what their representatives say to today. And until then, the Catholic Church said the Jews can never go back to Israel. They haven't accepted the Messiah. They renegated on what God told them to do. And take a look, we have Israel, we're back, and Jews coming, building, farming, protecting, army, etc. Kol Dodi Dofeik. And of course, then the question came, how do we respond? And there's no doubt in my mind that I'm sitting here in Yerushalayim, Mir HaKodesh, It will soon be my 49th Purim here, Pesach here. What are we heading for? 49th Yom HaTzmaut here. Part of the reason that I'm sitting here is because of Kol Dodi Dofek. How will you respond? How will you answer? God is knocking on your door. Now, this position paper, we can call it, with the Divrei Torah, became, within 10, 20 years, everyone realized no one has given such guidance, has stated it so eloquently, as the Rav did in 56. In the state of Israel, every yeshiva tichonid, every religious high school, every ulpana, every young child, we're talking now hundreds and hundreds of thousands, if not over a million, 2 million already, everyone is exposed to Kol Dodi Dofek. It's one of the required essays that they study during their high school years. All my grandchildren are familiar with Kol Dodi Dofek. It has conquered the world. Fine. So, ani makir tova to the Rav, Kol Dodi Dofek, the knocks on the door, as a guy named Rakefet has said in public more than once, and by the way, I brought people on Aliyah with this statement. I said, the choice is yours, to be another social security number or to affect the history of the Torah people. Choice is yours. Kol Dodi Dofek. You can tell the Ribbono Shel Olam, Pashatati et Kuntatai, Yechal Bishana, I'm graduating Einstein, I'm at home in America, I know the language, I know how to use the bank, Yechal, I can't, what can I get involved, how can I shift, go away, come back another time. Or you can embrace the knock on the door and you become part of the Torah people returning home and forging a new reality. Now let me go further. Arye, and I have to thank you next week. I'll show you the Rambam's Psak based on the Gemara in Tainet, but that's the next week, next time. Now we have to ask a very simple question. Tell me, Moriah Rebbe, Reb Soloveitchik, gives this talk. Where does he remain? He remains in Boston. Kol Dodi Dofek. You gave the talk. Live up to it. And it's even a more basic question, not just on the Rebbe who gave the talk, although it is certainly more succinct when you ask the person who spoke about Kol Dodi Dofek and heard the knocks, and he remains in Brookline, Massachusetts. But more than that, in my humble opinion, every Jew who believes in Torah has to be troubled if you don't live in Israel. How can you go on living in Flatbush and Borough Park, in Los Angeles and Detroit and Philadelphia and Boston, in Cape Town, in Johannesburg, in London, Liverpool, etc., etc., Melbourne, Sydney? Every Jew has to ask this question. Every Jew struggles with this issue. If you believe in Torah, unless you don't go to shul and pashat lech lecha. It is possible that there's some shuls in America that closed down, and maybe in Teaneck they closed the shuls, pashas lech lecha. Don't want to hear about the Borough Park, don't want to hear about Eretz Yisrael. But this is part of our difficulty, our quests, our current problems as religious people. How do we live as Torah Jews? Israel is here, alive, kicking, pleading for more Jews. Every Torah Jew living here dreams, daydreams. Imagine if 500,000 Jews came in Aliyah from the United States. What it would do for the state of Israel. Could you imagine in the next election, by a Yehudi, I could have just rail, Flatbush voting for Shas, let's say. Oh, what a results you would have. So this is a serious question. tell me, was the Rav asked this question? Who asked it? Who asked the
teacher?
So I want to tell you a story, and I made copies for everyone. Give out to everyone. I want to tell you an unbelievable story. In the Shomron, Kedumin. So the Rav was the Rav of the Yishuv with a Rav Shiloh. His wife, Miriam, taught in Givat Washington. Givat Washington is a right next to Kerem V'Yavna. There's a tremendous educational facility, Givat Washington, which began originally to train people to be involved in gymnastics, religious people to have gym teachers for the religious school system. And Givat Washington has expanded. It's essentially for women. There might be programs that are co-ed, postgraduate, I don't know. But it's essentially for women. There's many different types of collegiate opportunities for women. Today it's a major institution because the government is taking the teachers' colleges and merging them. Miriam Shiloh, Zichrona Levracha, evidently taught Kol Dodi Dofek to her class in the high school there, or in the Ulpana there. And it was right during the Six-Day War. And the Six-Day War broke out, the fear here, everyone was frightened here, frightened across the world. The Arabs were boasting, the Russians were boasting, in a few weeks we'll be rid of the State of Israel, and the Jewish people living there will be thrown into the sea outside Tel Aviv. A book was actually written afterwards. A funny thing happened to me on the way of Tel Aviv about NASA. And that was part of the title. And the class was filled with questions by these young girls, young women. Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote such a magnificent essay. Why didn't he come in Aliyah? And Miriam Shiloh had the chutzpah, I'll say, to write a letter to the Rav. And she asked the Rav the exact question, why didn't you come on Aliyah? Unbelievable. And more unbelievable, the Rav wrote a long letter back to her that I consider the second most important letter that the Rav has written that has surfaced. The first, I bow to Rabbi Lichtenstein, who calls the letter that a kid named Roshkoff got from the Rav in the early 60s, or may even be 60. So Rabbi Lichtenstein called that the most important letter the Rav has ever written. So I'll bow to Rabbaran and accept that as letter number one, which it probably is, because that deals with the heart of Torah. I consider this letter number two the second most important. But there's much more to the story. She got this answer, and people were busy building the Shomron. This is Gush Emunim. And she dies. She dies young. The Mechanechet, Rebbetzin Shiloh. 1999. I believe you see on the fourth paper there's a memorial for her, the Shloshim. It was on May 31st, 1999. Harav Daniel Shiloh was her husband. And when she died, they went through her papers and they found the correspondence with the Rav of some 30 years earlier. And someone told them to get in touch with me. And if you notice, on the letter of the Rav, you can see it's a fax. Today it's an old-fashioned thing. Today everything is scanned and sent email. There's a fax with the date when it was sent to me. It was towards the end of her life. And I publicized the letter. It made some waves here in the religious Zionist community. It was published in Be'sheva. But the letter was not really analyzed. And I want to talk about this letter today, which I think is epic-making and explains the Rev's mind and explains the quagmire, the dilemma that I referred to a few minutes ago, and answers your question when you say it, the Liechtensteins didn't give it the proper gestalt, I'll say, proper Stolzkeit. You follow? Proper pride. All right, was said a certain time, a certain audience. And first of all, you see the Rav's command of Hebrew, magnificent. Secondly, you see the Rav, there's so much in this letter, his wife. And these marriages are made in heaven, they're cemented upon earth. Not everyone has a marriage like the Rav had. I saw this with other Gedolei Yisrael as well. They could not function without their wives. As the Rav said a number of times in public, with my wife's death, a part of me went down to the grave as well. And that's point number one. Point number two, you see from the letter, that if the Rebbetzin had lived, this whole institution here would have been so different. Because by the late 60s, the Rav, the Rebbetzin, emotionally and psychologically, would have been ready to come in Aliyah. The Rebbetzin was pushing for it. She died right before the Six-Day War. Tainit Esther, 1967. Make the cheshbon. Six-Day War was later, early June. And she died, Tainit Esther, 1967. And everyone says that, and the family too, I validated it, that had the Rebbetzin lived, they would have come in Aliyah. The apartment that was built for the Rav, right down the hill, the big apartment with the building with four apartments in it, that apartment was built for the Rav. Mr. Gruss, I'll be very brief now because I've spoken about this at length, I've written about it, but Mr. Gruss, who became a very devoted follower of the Rav. The story was that there was a personal problem in the Gruss family, and Joe Gruss went to his brother Oscar. Oscar had a seat on the stock market. Joe Gruss had a seat in the stock market. These were not poor people. But the difference between them was that Oscar remained from in America, and Mr. Gruss, the shul he didn't daven in, was an Orthodox shul. So he went to his brother, and his brother said Oscar said to Joe, you know what, I'll take you to my Rebbe, maybe he can help you. So he comes to the Rav with the problem, and the Rav tells him, I can't help you, maybe my wife can help you. The Rebbe says, then get at Yiddish. They spoke Yiddish to each other. And he takes him to the Rebbetzin, and the Rebbetzin was able to help him. And Joe Gruss became a tremendous devotee of the Rav. And the Rav gave Mr. Gruss hell. How did you expect anything better if you didn't send your children to day school? You didn't give them an education? And from that point on, Mr. Gruss devoted his life. He said to me, I quote, these ears heard, he said, I want to die without a penny to my name. I've given my children, I've taken care of them. I want to give away everything I have to Torah education. And he went on a spree. If you walk through Borough Park, you'll see many institutions, Joseph and Caroline Gruss, and what he gave to YU, what he gave to the Rosh Yeshiva, what he did for me personally as a Rosh Yeshiva, overnight my salary doubled. That's how I get to Israel. I visited 68, and I vowed we would settle here. Within the year, my wife and I made a vow, and we were Makayim 10 months later. And Mr. Gruss started pressing the Rav. This is right after the Six-Day War. Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rebbe, you're the greatest teacher of Torah in the world. Du bist der beste Melamed in der ganzen Welt. Yedach melamed zayn teira in the best of plots for yid salayrin in teira. You have to teach Torah in the best place where you can learn Torah, Yerushalayim. And he had in mind, Mr. Gross, that this would be like the graduate school at, where Einstein was at Princeton. It would be a graduate school of the greatest minds coming from all over the Torah world to study with the Rav in Yerushalayim. What a dream. No, the Rav was broken in health, his wife was gone, so Mr. Gris pressed him, and the Rav said, okay, go ahead, build. The Rav probably figured till he gets the land, till he builds, Mashiach will be here. But he didn't know who Mr. Gris was. Mr. Gris pressed Teddy Kolek, the mayor. Kolek gave him this land, it was a vineyard, it was an orchard, gave him the land and told him, build. And Mr. Gris went ahead and built, and of course it's sad, you read about it in Washington, I produced the documents, the Rav by 75, when the building was ready, the campus was ready, the Rav didn't have the strength, the ability, he was aged already, he was ill, he couldn't come in Aliyah. And this campus was lost already for Torah, and again, a guy named Rakefet, God, Vayivtach Hashem et pi haton, God opened the donkey's mouth, and the right words were said to Mr. Gris, and if we're ever in the King David Hotel together, I'll show you exactly where we were standing, Joe Gris and Ani Rothkopf, and where we fell on each other's shoulders. I can show you exactly. A plaque should be built right there. On this spot, this building was given to Torah. Okay.
How old was the Rav when he passed?
The Rav was 90, but the last years he was totally out of it, Alzheimer's. Now, look at the letter. Look at the letter. Ani mevakesh slicha al asher lo nizkakti liyita b'tkifut v'yichati ad ha'kayri. Evidently, he was late in answering. He apologizes, and he says, it's very difficult for me, difficult to write. Look at these words, Shakua Hinini Ba'avelut Al Motrayati Hachamava Bavatainai Vechemdat Nafshi Zifrona Levracha Olomi Hitmotate Vecharev Ka'amur Gamach Shavani Kokrev Vedemu Vedam Libi Hakarua Vahamurutach. Look at that Hebrew, look at what he writes about his wife. And I can tell you, this is a blessing. This is a beautiful marriage. This is a role model. And I can tell you, the RCA convention, 1977. So the Rav was speaking about the Gemara in Sanhedrin having a positive attitude and giving the whole drasha on the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Dapfava, Midbeth, Dapsayin, Amid Aleph, the whole concept of Peshara. A beautiful drasha the Rav gave, RCA. And in the middle of the drasha, he eulogized his wife again. So I remember when the shiur was over, so it was amazing to see the comments of some of the rabbis. Some of them were in tears. They understood the Rav well. Rabbi Yeruchim Gerelik, I remember, Senyar, 10 years have gone by, what is he crying about? I remember one rabbi, shall remain nameless, he said, oh, if my Machashefer goes, I'll dance a Kazatska. I couldn't believe the reaction. But you see what the Rav... Steve, be quiet.
Beseda.
And so you see in the first paragraph, he talks about the Avela, Bat Einai, the heart of my eyes, my dear wife, Chemdat Nafshi, the love of my soul, my world has caved in and is destroyed. I'm writing in tears with my blood. My heart is broken and bitter. What a description. So you see right away you learn his relationship with the Rebbetzin, which of course we all understood. But then, look what he writes. Ani modela al devareha, v'ani makabel et tochateha biratzon. He says, I thank you for your words, and you have every right to rebuke me. Amnon chatati le'eretz hakodesh. I have sinned against the holy land. Hineni bein hamafagrim. Those, it's hard to translate mafager into English. The rabbi's calling himself in Hebrew. We use it for people who are not totally normal. I'm among those that are abnormal. And he says, Muvan, it's understandable. Shahabei garmin bilti tluyim biyichvuni. A lot of actions, a lot of happenings happened that I had no control over. And I was held back. Nevertheless, I'm not looking for excuses. I don't want to defend myself. Ashamti. And listen to this. Eshtaket hechlatnu aniverayatizau lavo arza v'lasot shema k'shisha chadashim k'dei lirot et ha'aretz v'et ha'am ha'yoshev ba ulam rabot machshavot b'leiv adam ira ma she'ira v'rabot anchati v'libi daivai. Wow. And here he says openly, this was the original plan. Here you have a document from the Rav certifying what we did and found out in our research. The original plan was he would spend half the year in Israel and half the year back in America. And he would teach here, teach in America, and everyone here, I was a kid then, I can't say I was heavily involved in trying to influence the Rav, but there was a rabbi, Lenny Rosenfeld. Anyone recognize the name? Lenny Rosenfeld was new. Whose son-in-law was he? Leo Young's son-in-law. Rabbi Lenny Rosenfeld lived in the Gush already, and he pleaded with the Rav to come, and he told him, you'll see the students you will get here, the atmosphere here. Ultimately, you will never want to go back. You'll spend the whole year teaching here. And wow. Had the Rebbetzin lived, the final chapter of the Rav's life would have been so different. And here he goes on, many of my friends, those who know me, those who are my buddies, pleaded me to come now. He's referring to pressure we're putting from here. But I have to say that you stress in your letter how much I'm needed in Israel now. It's a mashber ruchani. People need guidance, but I can't give it now. And here, look what the Rav refers to. And you see, even in a simple letter like this, he brings a beautiful Maimon Chazal. Look up the Medrash Rabbah to Shmot, Perek Nun Bet, right at the end. I repeat the Medrash Rabbah to Shmot. I'm giving the source. He quotes it, but he doesn't give the source. Omar Rabbi Yochanan, Kipa shel cheshba not hayata chutz l'Yerushalayim. V'chol mi shemavakesh l'chashev holech sham. Lama shelo yechashev b'Yerushalayim v'yitza lefi shenikra mesos kol ha'aretz. What is the Medrash saying?
Medrash Rabbah
to Shmot, right at the end of Perek Nun Bet in the Medrash Rabbah, Pashat Pekudei. You know what the Medrash is talking about? Very simple. Here, Yomo has a visa, a charge account, all right? And he has to make a cheshbon. They're going to bill him February 2nd. Now he has to have enough money in the bank to cover the charge. So you know what the Medrash says? He has to go outside Yerushalayim to make the cheshbon. Why? Very simple. Because he sees a bill coming up of 4,500 shekel. He only has in his account 4,000 shekel. He's going to be feeling very bad when he makes the cheshbon. Where do I come up with that extra 500 shekel? Ah, to feel bad? Not in Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim, Mesos Kol Haaretz. Unbelievable. You hear what the Rav is saying? He's saying, how can I come in Aliyah? To come in Aliyah, you have to be happy. You have to have a good spirit. And here I am so upset now. And here he goes further. And if the Medrash is talking about money, Hadavarim kal v'chomer l'kipa shel avelet kodedet. If you're worried about money, your 500 fashtunken a shekel that you're short, all right, Yomel, go on Rechov for Ben Yehuda and play music. He plays the band, I don't know, a guitar, and he'll collect money. He'll sing songs in Russian, in Yiddish, in English. Baruch Hashem. But avelet, a deep, deep avelet. I can't come to Yerushalayim. Eichav shali achshav la'alot Yerushalayim v'ani ish k'shei ruach u'man nefesh. Ein hashra'a chala b'matzav shel dika'on atzvut v'tzah. How can I come? How can I be spiritually alone?
I think it's a poor excuse.
Herbie, relax yourself. Have respect. Have respect. In the next paragraph will solve your problem. But I want you to feel what a document, what Hebrew, what insight. Herbie, relax. I'll get there. Herbie, I agree with you, but that's not the point. Now you have to understand the Rav. You're asking me? Every Jew should be.
No, I just made a statement.
But no, the Rav is deeper. You'll see in the last paragraph. But you see, until now, what a human document. What Hebrew. The Maimer Chazal. What understanding. What love. And now you understand the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Chaf Bet. That when a man's an eshet nurim, when the wife of your youth dies, it's churban bayit. It's like churban beit hamikdash. L'chol yesh tmura, the Gemara says, chutz me eshet nurim. Everything in life can be replaced. You have a radio, you broke the radio, you get a new radio. A computer, someone just told me a story, they had to get the computer fixed. What they went through to get someone to make a phone call today, you got to be a genius. Press this, press that, press the other thing. But I learned the secret. Sometimes if you press zero, you get a human being. You get an operator. But they don't tell you that. I just this morning succeeded in getting a human being by pressing zero. So everything can be replaced. But Eshit Me'urav, and when a Zivik is Ole Yafa, and when it's a real partnership, look at the Rav, look at his response, look at his admitting he's a sinner. Wow. One paragraph further, the last paragraph, and the last paragraph is dynamite. And it catches us in a quandary that we struggle with until this very moment, with all due respects to Herb or Chaim. See, the Rav, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, they face this problem. The Rav meets me in the elevator. It has to be about 64. And the Rav says to me, I hear good things about you. You know how to excite the students, teaching them a taisvus. So the Rav said this to me. I've told you this before. But what's the Rav saying? The Rav is saying to me, Baruch Hashem, we have you here in the yeshiva. You were educated here. You know the lingo. You know the language, you know the mentality, you know the students. I'll go one step further. You know baseball. Solomon Schechter already said in the early 1900s that you can't be a rabbi in America, you can't teach Torah unless you know baseball. That's Solomon Schechter speaking, a greenhorn. Even the Rav, in 77 in his Pesach Shir, he said to the audience, I'm just warming up now. I'm just warming up. Everyone was hysterical, but he knew the lingo. So you see, if people like us go in Aliyah, what's going to happen to the Jews back home? This is a real quandary. It's a real question. It's a quagmire. There's no easy answer. I mean, I have my point of view. My point of view is very different, but that doesn't solve the problem. You have to recognize the dilemma. And more than that, what is the most important facet of Torah, of Yahadut, Judaism, whatever you wish to call it, the Rav will itvaken. Most important facet of Torah? Study Torah, teaching Torah. How many bracha did you make this morning? You woke up, Asher Yatsa, on the Tilat Yodayim, on learning Torah, three major brachot. La'asok, right or wrong, Harevna, Asher Baruch Habanu. Wow. You come to the Haggadah, think for one moment. Kineged Abba Banim Divra Torah. And a whole introduction with Birchat HaTorah, basically. And four different children. And the Rav said time and again, this is the most important part of the Haggadah, passing it on, and not passing it on only to geniuses. To teach geniuses, this is the old question in the yeshiva. How do you run your classes? Who do you teach to? What level do you teach to? What do you do with a kid who's not on the same level as the rest? All right, you can take a point of view. I'm only for the best. I can't worry about anyone else. But that's not a Torah point of view. A Torah can negative a banim. To be a great teacher for geniuses, that doesn't require much ability. But to be a teacher who can reach out to all the students, and without the study of Torah, the Jewish people have no future. So you see, you have a conflict of values here. On one hand, Eretz Yisrael is Eretz Yisrael. This is where it's at. This is the heart. This is the future. This is the home that is indigenous to Torah civilization. But concomitantly, what do you do with everyone left behind? And I think in the last paragraph, the Rav is really cutting all the fat away, and he's coming into his real understanding and his real justification of why he's in Brookline. And he says, "Ein gevir titzri chalitz tadek al dvarei." You don't have to apologize, because she evidently, we don't have her letter, but she evidently wrote to him, "Ani Yehudiya Pshuta. I'm a simple Jewish woman," and he writes back, "I'm a Yehudi Pashut," and Hayiti Omer, and he's paraphrasing the Gemara in Brachot, where Ani Melamed v'Habei Hamalim imatzibur b'stei Achinach Torani Melamdin Ani Malachti b'Ir New York Hagadola b'Mosad Rav Talmidim v'Gam Melachtam בגבעת וושינגטון או במושב אחר במוצד מצומצם בכמותו אחד המבר ואחד הממית ובלבד שיכוון את ליבו לשמיים מלאכת כולנו מוקדשת לטיפוח ערכי היהדות מסורת אבות ותורת רבותינו בעלי הקבלה והחכמיה. And the Rav is saying, no apologies needed. We're both involved in the same calling, the same profession. We're teaching Torah, we're teaching Mesorah. I'm teaching in a big institution in a big city like New York with many students. But you're teaching in Givat, Washington. It may be a smaller institution. You have less students. But we're all involved in the same goal, to create Yirat Shemayim l'tipuach erkei hayadut mesorat avot v'torat rabokeinu balei kabal v'hachamecha echad hamabe v'echad hamamid ubuvad sheyechavim libo l'shemayim. And here, this is really the heart of the issue. This explains the Rav. This explains the Lubavitcher Rebbe. There was a graduate in the yeshiva a few years older than me, Rabbi Green. I don't believe he's alive. If I'm wrong, I'd be happy to be corrected. He went to a suburb of Toronto. He built a community there, Yesh Me'ayin. It was a shame Dov, I think his first name was Morty Green. He was a chavruta with Rabbi Isaacs. They learned with chavruta together. Isaacs wound up in Maine. What city in Maine?
Bangor,
Maine. Right. One of his daughters married Nair, Richie Nair's brother. Richie was my student, came from Bangor, Maine. Harab Betzalel Na'ar today, big Talmud Chacham. And they learned with chavruta, went in for the Bechina together. And Rabbi Green wound up in a suburb of Toronto, as I recall, very matzliach. And then came the Six-Day War. He was all excited, and he wants to go in Aliyah, and he goes and asks the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He walked in certain that the Rebbe would tell him, go and be matzliach and have influence, and the Rebbe told him, absolutely forbidden for you to go an Aliyah. And I have to say, the same thing with the Rav. He wasn't happy when Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein came in Aliyah. You all know that the Rav wasn't happy. Rabbi Aaron, his son-in-law, YU product mentality, PhD from Harvard. Wow. We didn't ask the Rav. We're not chassidim. It's a different approach on our part. But you have to understand, this is a quagmire. And that answer to Rebbetzin Shiloh, to Miriam Shiloh, this is really the heart of the answer. Yes, I'm very upset, I'm in mourning, I'm writing with blood, it's difficult for me, but when all is said and done, I have an important role here. We're teaching Torah. You're teaching Torah, I'm teaching Torah. And on that level, it doesn't matter whether it's in Givat Washington or in New York City. The future of the Jewish people depends upon the teaching of Torah. So you see, Aryeh, kol do bido fake. I don't believe the Rav realized when he was composing the Masa, the Drasha, the lecture. I don't believe he realized how far reaching implications this lecture will have. But here, Rebbetzin Shiloh challenges him, and he responds. Part of the response, historically, is very interesting. Gross, his plans, 6 months here, 6 months there, the Rebbetzin dies, and that alters everything on a personal level. His feeling for the Rebbetzin, the marriage, the description. I don't believe you have many Anashim Gedolim who wrote in such a heartfelt way about their wives, their relationship, and Churban HaBayit when an Eshet Nurim dies. But that last paragraph is crucial. And this quagmire we live with until today. Now, I want to take off 2 minutes. I want to take off 2 minutes, and I want to give you my own opinion, which I stated years ago in the Kollel, and I dealt with this within the topic of Zionism. The Rav's question is a legitimate question. Rabbi Hertz has a kehillah there. Anything new with Bert left, by the way? Nothing. Anyway, it's a legitimate question. Lubavitcher Rebbe, I know in Russia we dealt with it many times when we worked to get people out of Russia. So if he was a Lubavitcher, you would hear people saying, no, the Rebbe told him El Zo Bleiben, he should remain there, he should teach there. And it comes up quite often where the Rebbe told people to remain there. There's another example. There was a very prominent, I believe I have it right, Kalms, K-A-L-M-S, very prominent businessman, a Ben Torah, a fighter for Lubavitch in London, and Peter Combs, I think was his name. I remember teaching his daughter in Michlala, and he wrote a memoir where he asked the Rebbe, he wanted to go in Aliyah desperately, and the Rebbe, and he was not a rabbi, but he was a prominent balabas. The Lubavitch told him, remain in London, that's where you can discharge your obligations. I'll tell you, in my own humble opinion, is exactly like Herbie. Every Jew belongs in Israel. This is where it's at. And you come in Aliyah, unwanted, uncalled, unsought, and somehow I look around at my children, my grandchildren, I am overwhelmed. Each one finds their place 100%. Now, what about the Jews that are left behind? So the Rakefa plan is very simple. The Jewish agency has to set up, which they do have somewhat, a whole division. We supply Rabbanim, we supply teachers for the Gola. They come for not more than 5 years. They want to come back to Israel. We don't want them to get lost and to remain in the Gola. But we'll supply, and that has a dual advantage. One advantage is if they're supplied from Israel, they are Rabbanim. They rule. The Balabatim are not going to tell them what to do. Those of you that are in the rabbinate, believe me, many a time you have a problem where the Balabatim are running the shul halachically and not the rabbi. So that gives one advantage. They're not talui b'dei acherim. Their salary is paid by the Jewish agency. Like kashrut, the shul, like the OU, the shul pays the Jewish agency. The Jewish agency pays the rabbanim, the machanchim, the melamdim. It's like the OU. It's not between the balabas for whom you're giving hashkacha. He is paying you directly. And that would be one advantage. The second advantage, obviously, is it sets Israel where it really belongs as our major priority. And this would be a dream. Is it coming about? To a certain degree. To a certain degree, the Jewish agency sends hundreds and hundreds of teachers to the Gola every year. Rabbi Riskin has a whole program, Strauss Amiel, which similarly sends Rabbanim many places all over Europe. No rabbi wants to go there, and they don't want Chabad. Chabad will go all over, but these people don't want a Chabad person. Fine. They supply Rabbanim. Many of them are Lamdanim. They're Israeli products. They're fine individuals. And it works out very well. They go, they stay, they build, they do, and then they come home, Baruch Hashem, and their children don't suffer. Generally, when you raise children on foreign soil, you have much less success with the children. I don't have to go further than the Lau family. The Lau family, so you all know that the chief rabbi's life was saved by his older brother, Lavi. He Hebraized his name. And he was in the foreign ministry. He was the consul in New York. He was in the foreign ministry of the State of Israel. His kids were raised here, there, and everywhere. So lo aleinu, I don't want to talk, two sons Rabbanim, one of them is here, a Rav, a prominent rabbi, goes to a wedding of gays, it hurts me to talk about it, and blesses them.
No, I found out. All he did was attend.
Picture they show is he's giving a bracha. I saw the picture, I don't know if it was in public or private, doesn't matter. He attended. That itself is a statement, capital S. And the other brother in America is a Mahalo Shabbos, the guitar, a gay in his own life, conservative rabbi. So you see, you pay a price. You pay a price when you educate kids here, there, and everywhere. This system, the Rakefet system, you go when you can, when the kids are young, you bring them back for the heart of their education, you'd have a lot more success than when it's Hefka. But the problem is real. Okay, so I want to reiterate, halacha lemaisa, there's no question that the Kol Dodid they fake may have been the most important moment in the Rav's life as far as the influence. It has influenced, hundreds of thousands. It may already be over 1 million. And he was challenged. Rebbetzin Miriam challenged him. I don't know if we would have the nerve. Rebbe, why don't you come in Aliyah? I don't know if we would have that nerve, but she challenged him. She said, I'm a simple Jewish girl, but my students are asking me, you wrote the Kol Dodid Dofek, you heard the Kol, you heard the Dafikot and the Delet, why aren't you here? And the Rav's answer is very moving, very insightful, very revealing, but the most important part, there's written L'Shem U'L'Tiferet, and then you come down to the hardcore. That last paragraph is crucially important, my humble opinion, and I believe my interpretation of it is absolutely correct. So I want to thank the Rav for the kol do di do fake, how much it influenced my life, and Baruch Hashem, I'm here with all that that implies. Am I correct in my hashkafa? The issue hangs fire. I feel that way. The Lubavitcher Rebbe felt differently. The Rav evidently felt differently. But take a look what happens as time moves on. Most of the Rav's family is here. Make the cheshbon with his grandchildren. How many are here and who's in the United States? So you see, life moves on. And somehow, Yosef Yechav, you see what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants. Okay, questions. Rabbi Hertz.
He wrote this 4 months after the Rebbetzin passed away.
Approximately.
If he would have been asked this question 5-10 years later, would he have answered the same way?
I think the last paragraph stands. That's why I say the last paragraph is crucially important. But you got to remember, he also mourned 10 years later. I can still remember, I see Rabbi Ruchem Yeralik, and I remember I was there and then with this other moron, I would dance a Kazatska. But there was one rabbi accused of killing his wife. I remember the funeral, and don't ask what happened there with the father. Ay, God.
Why did he ever come to visit?
Reform rabbi.
The reform rabbi went to jail. He killed his wife. That was a New Jersey story. There's also a New Jersey story. And she drowned in the bathtub. He was never indicted. It was just... with life, you have to have mazel. And with a wife, I don't have to say that people sitting here this way, that way, I don't have to elaborate.
Why
he never visited is very simple. He visited once in 35, as you know. The Lubavitcher Rebbe never visited. But the Rav had a real problem. Blood is thicker than mud. And the problem was with his family. Could you picture the Rav coming and not giving a shiur in Heichal Shlomo? Heichal Shlomo then was like the Beis HaMikdash. When I came in Aliyah, Heichal Shlomo was in a club. Who would ever believe that Heichal Shlomo is a school building? You follow?
No, they have a building downstairs.
No, I know, but it's not.
It used to be
the chief rabbinate, and the Beit and HaGadol sat there. Don't ask. So Revelvo put it into Chayrim. One of the things that the Haredi world hides is that Rav Yashiv used to go into Heichal Shlomo. They have pictures of him. He was in the rabbinate. He was a dayan. So they have pictures. How could he go in against the Chayrim Rav Yashiv going in? So they hide the facts, as you know, not hard for them to do. All right. For the Rav to come and take on the family, he was very, very hesitant. Another part of the problem was, in Boston, you see, we'll talk about it on the Monday class, Reb Leizer Silber was a master of politics as well. The Rav thought he could become a master of politics, but the Kashrut scandal in Boston and all that went on, it absolutely, I would say, decimated him is the word you used? I would say pushed him into a corner. He'd salti et nafshi fi shalom al Yisrael. And the Rav used to say, I told you this more than once, it still rings in my ears, he says, when I get onto the plane to fly back to Boston and the doors of the plane close, I relax. And he said about New York, it's like a zoo. Every animal has his own cage and yet they're barking at each other. He went back to Boston, but you see what the Rav was saying, unfortunately, you look at the Torah world, how much machloket there is. It's so sad. You understand? You look what goes on here. You'll say, at least in the Mizrahi world, we have tremendous machloket, but it's a little bit dignified. I don't believe anyone is going to go to a grave and destroy the matzeva. Here you saw with your own eyes, you saw the picture. I mean, it's hard to understand how Jewish kids can do this. Hard to understand. The Rav was frightened by that. He'd come to Israel, the politics, the Mizrahi, the Aguda, his family. He was frightened. So if you read the letters I produced in Washington, Lenny Rosenfeld tells the Rav, I know you're worried there'll be demonstrations. He says, so what? They'll demonstrate 1 week, 2 weeks. within a few months it'll be ancient history and you'll be able to do what you want to do to teach Torah. So he encouraged him, but that was the reality. With the briska, you understand, on the other side of the coin, the briska here recognized they're in debt to the Rav. So there was a certain, I would say, a truce between them that they tried to renoise Nishta Mizrachi, you know, they were trying to rewrite who the Rav was, but they could never disown him. Because he supported them, there was the family connection. It was deeper than any politics, than any hashkafa issue. And he was frightened about it. So I'll tell you a story, let me be honest with you. In the early 70s, it began in New York. We all were here, you know, after the Yom Kippur, after the Six-Day War, suddenly there's a presence of Rabbanim, of YU type people in Israel. A small presence, but we were here. So in New York, they were pleading with the Rav, Rebbe, you have to visit Israel, you have to see what's going on. It's time, 6 days, forget about your mourning already. People who could talk to the Rav, like Manny Holzer, Fabian Schoenfeld. I mean, they spoke with the Rav, you know, friend to friend. And they let him have it if need be, in a nice way. He was the Rav. So they convinced him that he said, no, the trip is too long. No, it's not too long. You'll fly to England. You'll sleep a few days in London. Then you'll fly on to Israel. Do you know that they actually made arrangements? And at this end, we arranged, I don't know if we had every day covered, but like I had one day a week I could block out and not teach, and take Rebbe wherever he wants to go, show him around, etc. Had a whole program arranged. Nothing came out of it. Nothing came out of it. And I think, you see, to take on a task like this, you have to be young. Once his wife died, old age illness crept up upon him very, very quickly. Okay, so that's the answer. I think that's the only answer. Many people have asked the question and they give people pulling. Yeah, you got to face life. When I was younger, I taught 32 hours a week. Could you imagine? Today I teach technically 4 hours a week. All right, I prepare, spend endless time, etc. A lot more going on in my life and learning. But I teach 4 hours a week. I'm more tired teaching 4 hours than I used to be teaching 32 hours. The answer is age. So you have to be realistic. The Rav was not the Baruch Hashem. Rabbi Reuben, what's up?
Now, for the analogy of the people sitting here, a book came out of the correspondence of the Rav, and this entire letter and the correspondence of Miriam Shiloh to the Rav and back is in the book.
Which book are you referring to?
I don't know.
Talking about Torah Tarav,
Nani. No, it's in English.
Nadi Helfgott.
The correspondence of
Nadi Helfgott, yeah, it's in there?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, can anyone else confirm that? I'll check it later.
I haven't known.
Okay, bring it.
All the books.
It's also in the Ben Yachid.
Yeah, because I'm very happy to hear that. Because
that way, next time you teach this, you can translate from you can do the English.
No, but say that I can do the English. We did the English. But I consider this letter very, very important. You follow? In the sense that the Rav opens up his heart, and the last part of the letter is classic. It's a problem we struggle with until today.
You see, in the book, he has, for example, the question of Orthodox Rabbi via chaplain.
Yeah, so it's Nadi Helfgott's book.
And then he has a chapter at Cornell University, a man wanted to donate $1 million for stained glass windows.
Right, if they're allowed.
The Orthodox professor at Cornell went to the president and said, I'd like to get an opinion from Rabbi Soloveitchik. And the Rav's opinion was written out in the book, and the man was so impressed by what the Rav wrote that they did exactly what he said.
Right. Now, I know what book you're referring to. That deals with the Shabbos, the shul in Connecticut, I believe it was, Rabbi Gorelick's shul, where someone had a factory and he willed it to the shul and all the profits, but the problem was it was open on Shabbos. So they came up with a solution to sell it to a guy. have the Gaudi and the Rebbe supposed? Because everyone knows their synagogue running a factory. It's a very, very...
The guy was to take the Shabbos profit.
Yeah, yeah, no.
Not
but,
the rest of it.
No, no, I understand. But Stam Mechira.
The kosher soup restaurant in downtown in Boston, in the financial district, that's strictly kosher. And on Shabbos, all the profits... as by the manager, who's not Jewish.
He's not Jewish. All right, say that. If you follow through with that, it's like Rabbi Riskin now proposed here with Rabbi Madan. They're going to have buses on Shabbos with the Goyim running the buses. No, is that a Shabbos? Is that a solution?
He wanted to do that
in the 70s. He announced it then, and the Rav shot him down. But the Rav's not around today, so you can do it. Okay, let's go further. Gentlemen, Adkan, the Zionism, Adkan, the impact, Adkan, the Hakarat HaTov, Farah Rakepet. But now I want to come to what perhaps is the most important part of the Rav as a Rebbe, as a Malamed. And here I want to quote the Rav, and this deals with all of us who are teaching Torah. I admit it may not have to do with this classroom, with postgraduate, with a kollel. But certainly when you're teaching Torah on a high school level, a collegiate level, elementary school, this is a basic question. And when Reb Aaron Cutler died, and again, you see the Rav had a very unique and deep relationship with Reb Aaron Cutler. You saw that from the Shiloh with Cuba, with Chilul Yom Kippur, and who did the Rav call to consult? Reb Aaron Cutler, not anyone else. And that relationship went on with Reb Shneur. I also can tell you what I heard from Reb Shneur Cutler with these own ears, that when he came back to America from Israel, where he studied with his grandfather, Reb Issa Zalman, in Eitz Chaim, in Yerushalayim, the Rav told him, Reb Aaron Cutler sent him to the Rav Sheyurim in YU. I don't know how long it was, how many months, whether it was a year or more. He actually sat in the Rav Sheyurim. And I asked him, how were you impressed? Was von Eindruck hat das gemacht? How did it impress you? So he answered that the Rav was something special, he said. Oh, what insight. But he said the students, he didn't like the way they were dressed. He said they didn't seem to, it's hard for him to conceive that they were all yeshivish people. All right, that's an answer. I guess coming from Yerushalayim and the way they dressed here and coming to Washington Heights might have been an eye-opener. Today, I don't know if that's true. Today, many people wear... who sat in YU? Aryeh, in YU today, and you go into a shir, let's say, Rabbi Shechter shir, Rabbi Willick shir. How many fellas are wearing black pants and white shirts? What percentage?
Most of them.
Most. So you see today, half and half. All right. So you see the problem ameliorated itself. All right. Not to the Rav's happiness, but that's a different story. But the Rav made a very interesting point. The Rav was a master teacher. And he said, when I teach, I attempt to teach everybody in the classroom. He said, Reb Aaron Cutler, when Reb Aaron gives a shiur, it's only to the Iluyim. And what the Rebbe is referring to, I heard shiurim from both of them, so I can tell you, this comment was very insightful. Anyone who was in Lakewood, I've said it many times, but you can read memoir literature, Reb Aaron began his shiur. You could follow him 10 minutes, 12 minutes, 15 minutes. Only the Iluim could follow him after 18 minutes. Not only that, Reb Aaron ran on so quickly. He was like a mountain, like a volcano that was exploding. And you've heard tapes of Reb Aaron, you can hear the tape, and he gets carried away and you barely can make out his words. He swallows, he runs in. The Rav, on the other hand, when he taught, he could go slowly. He could repeat a point. He could develop a point. But there was an absolute effort to reach out that everyone in the room could understand him. You didn't have to be an Ilui to ultimately chop the Rav. This was one fascinating part of the Rav that hit me between the eyes, coming from Rabbaran Kutler Sheyurim to Mori Rebbe Sheyurim. But there was something else about the Rav which is very, very interesting. And this too, anyone who sat with the Rav, at least in my time, will testify this is absolutely so. He had Rabbaran Kutler, who was known, Kletzker Rosh Yeshiva, Lakewood, Agudat Yisrael, Chinuch Atzmai. There was no shock that when Rabbaran Kutler gave Sheyurim, you never had any general knowledge, any worldly culture. It was kulo Litvish Teira, kulo a Litvish approach, etc. You know what's amazing? In the Rav Shir, here is a man had a PhD from the University of Berlin. Here is a man who knew science, mathematics, he loved mathematics, philosophy, world philosophy. There was no end to what the man knew, how many languages. In the Shir, he was absolutely like Rabbaran Kutler. You had no hint that he knew anything outside of Shas, Peskim, and Reb Chaim Sterach. Yitz, am I right or wrong? And I can tell you, here, this is, I write about this. In all the years I sat in the Rav Sheyur, I'm talking in the yeshiva, in the Sheyur, I'm not talking the public lectures where he got involved in philosophy and Agada and homiletics, but in the Sheyur, it was kulo Torah, pure, unadulterated. The only time in all the years I sat in front of the Rav that we got a hint that he knew more than Shas and Peskim was a very fascinating story. And here I want to recall the name, someone who's not with us already a number of years, Nebuch, his family has paid a heavy price for their aliyah, Rabbi Aaron Bat. How many of you remember the name? Aaron Bat, his grandson was killed in the Merkaz HaRav massacre, the tragedy of a little over a year ago, Rabbi Mark from this building being killed. Rabbi Mark was married to his daughter, Chavi Mark, who lost an eye and is still undergoing surgery and plastic surgery. Oh, God have mercy. That's Aaron Bat's daughter. So Aaron Bat was a Talmud Rav, not just a Talmud Rav. He's slightly older than I am. He was the son of Charles Bat. Anyone recognize that name? Charlie Bat, a musmach of Teira Vidas, was one of the real lay leaders of Torah when it wasn't popular to fight for Torah. He was a businessman in Connecticut. The Rav knew the Bat family. They were part of the New England crowd of people who fought for Torah. So Aaron was a Talmud of the Rav, and he actually in 1956, when they started recording the Rav in the classroom, the only one the Rav trusted to record him was Aaron Bat. Because the Rav was paranoid that someone would take a recording and copy it, and his Torah would start to spread all over the world. I don't know, he was paranoid about it, but Aaron Bat from New Haven, he trusted. He was a New Englander. And Aaron used to carry the tape recorder in. It was very, very heavy. Two, three people had to carry it. And Aaron took the reel. He would give it to the Rav. He would mark it. So this was Aaron Bat. So one time, the Rav is giving shir. And his throat is starting to bother him. And he asks one of the fellas sitting near the door to go across the street to the Greasy Spoon and get him a cup of tea. Whatever it costs, 5 cents, whatever, I forget already. The Greasy Spoon was across, I don't know what it's called today, but it's one of the eateries across the street from the yeshiva. It wouldn't rate stars on a culinary list, but at least you could get a cup of tea there. Baruch Hashem, in Israel, I always say they don't pay salaries, but at least tea and coffee. I remember Macon Gold, fresh cake every morning, 10:30, hot out of the oven in the teacher's room. So the kid comes back. I'm telling it as it was. I don't remember who the kid was. A kid in the class. Kid comes back with the cup in a plastic cup with a plastic cover. And the Rav opens the cup, and on top of the tea, there's like a white plastic substance floating around. So the Rav wonders, is this dirt? Can I drink it? And Aaron Bat shoots, was a chemistry major. So Aaron Bat says something about chemistry, the interaction, and not to worry, it's the heat with the plastic, with the plastic, with the hot water. And the Rav starts talking with Aaron Bat chemistry formulas. And we were sitting there, we were like ready to faint. That here is Rebbe, Rebbeinu Shalom. Look what he knows about chemistry. Can you imagine what he knows elsewhere? And here I am, page 113 of Washington, and obtained the tea in the greasy spoon. This was a luncheonette located on Amsterdam Avenue, which catered to the yeshiva students. The tea came in a plastic-covered cup. When the Rav removed the cover, he noticed there were some foreign objects floating on top of the tea. He showed the cup to Aaron Bat, a student who was later to attain an advanced degree in chemistry. Aaron looked at the cup and decided that it was part of the plastic cover that had melted due to the heat of the tea. Within seconds, he and the Rav were exchanging chemical equations to explain this phenomenon. Okay? That was the only time in all the years I studied with the Rav that I saw in the classroom there was much more. Yes, Yitzchak?
Now, in Saturday night's show in Boston.
That was a different story.
That was different.
No, no. The public lectures were totally different. All right, let me just...
The first time that I heard a bunch of Shrike.
Yeah, we'll come to that. Leave that out.
The first time I heard of Prometheus, Greek mythology, was it a Saturday
no,
night?
No, there's no question what the Rav knew. You don't have to go to the Saturday night shir. Just open up Ish Halakha and take a look at the footnotes. And we'll come to that, but not yet. I just want to end off. I just want to go one step further. And the Rav's whole attitude towards college, and I referred to this last week, I believe it was. It was a very interesting attitude. It was not an attitude of integration or synthesis. It was more an attitude of harmonious coexistence. And the story I tell with Chaim Gold, that story, it's amazing. I've told the story. I write about it in Washington. You'll find it right in this chapter. And it's been quoted and requoted. I actually appear in other books. They cite the story and cite it properly. But that story, very, very revealing. Who was Chaim Gold? Chaim Gold was the grandson of Rabbi Zev Gold. His father was the first rabbi of Englewood. His father, I believe his father's name is Rabbi Moshe Gold. You can correct me if I'm wrong. His father died young. So here he was learning in Jerusalem. Chaim sent to learn, be near his grandfather. And when the grandfather died, the father died, the mother brought him back to America. And I was overwhelmed. Here is a kid. I can touch him. I can learn with him. He actually learned in Yerushalayim. He walked the streets of Yerushalayim. So Chaim Gold and I were Chavruta part of the time, 1 year, second year, everyone else goes up to college, and Chaim doesn't go up to college. So I went over to him, I said, why are you still in the Beis Medrash? It's 3 o'clock, college began. No, I'm taking off the year, nothing for me, and I can see already, I didn't realize it, but it was a good Yerushalayim attitude. Who the heck needs college, a waste of time? I'd seen it in Lakewood, so I understood already what's happening. So I was a yenta, plain and simple. I took responsibility for others. So I go to the Rav, and I say, Rebbe, Chaim Gold is not going to college. He's just sitting in the Beis Medrash after 3. And the Rav looks at me, and he says, what? Bring her to me. This is, he's sitting, the Rav's sitting in 102. I bring him in, and I'll never forget the conversation. And it reveals the Rav's thinking. He says to Chaim, Chaim, what's this I hear from Arnold that you're not going to college? And Chaim starts double talking. The Rav says, no. And the Rav quotes the Gemara that you don't have a father. Beit Din is responsible for you. For your taimen, Beit Din has the achrayat. I am responsible for you. And the Rav says, and I quote word by word, I don't know for sure what it means when Chazal tell us in Pirkei Avot, Yofet Talmid Torim Derech Eretz. I don't know what Derech Eretz means. But one thing I can tell you, Chaim, at this moment in time, Derech Eretz means you have to go to college. So Chaim sees he's losing the battle. He says to the Rav, Rebbe, it's after registration. It's too late. I missed the boat. The Rav says, you go upstairs and register. I will take care of it. And with that, I walk out with the Rav. Chaim goes up the stairs. And the Rav says to me, Arnold, who do I have to speak to? I say, Professor Silverman. He was the registrar. A nice guy. So the Rav goes to Dr. Belkin's office. I'm reliving it. I was right. And Mrs. Atlas, that was Dr. Belkin's girl Friday. Rabbi Soloveitchik, what can I do for you? What can I do for you? Give me a phone. I have to call Silverman. She dials the Rav. And the Rav says, Professor Silverman, this is Joseph Soloveitchik speaking. Do me a favor. A young man will come up to you to register. Help him with everything. Okay? About a half hour later, Chaim comes down. And I said, how did it go? He says, oh, it was fabulous, he says. I got every class I wanted, and all late registration fees were waived. And in addition, Professor Silverman said, Chaim, be sure to tell Rabbi Soloveitchik how I helped you. Okay? So, but what with that little story, you start to understand the Rav very well. The classroom was not a synthesis. Some people will try to teach Gemara and bring in the general sources and postgraduate sources and doctoral sources and analytical sources and show you Gemara and in Princeton and in Yale, they're doing basically analyzing the same problems. Not the Rav. He did not believe in synthesis.
Yes,
but it was a harmonious coexistence. All right, I'll pick up right where I left off.
He did something in his demolish year that I never heard another Rebbe do.
Right.
He defined terms. For example, Basel Bechol, Fila Betzibor. He defined a term that it, so he didn't just hear a phrase. He, in defining the term, he made it easy to understand
the halacha. Right. No, the Rav will talk about his ability to make everything crystal clear, to bring bris to life. But I just want to capture the general picture that with all the secular knowledge of the Rav, it did not mean that the classroom was any different than any traditional yeshiva that you will name. Okay, so
what
let me...
What happened to Chaim Gold?
Chaim Gold went on to become a...
He became in
Manhattan. What's it called? The big... Manhattan Day School.
Years and years.
The big... He was your teacher, Rabbi Hertel's teacher. He was there for many, many years. He was married to Rabbi Rubin's late sister, Sarah. We used to call her Carrot Top. She had red hair, and she was a sweetheart. She married Chaim Gold, and Lo Aleinu, like the Rav, he never got over the death of his wife. It's a sad story on that level. He lives in Kew Gardens Hills, and he's retired today. He's no youngster. He's maybe a year or two behind me, but not any younger. Okay, so to reiterate, So today we analyzed the Kol Dovido fake. We came back to that magic moment. And the Rebbe's letter, which is so crucial, but I believe that last paragraph is really the heart of it. We began to speak about the Rebbe as a teacher, the classroom, and we made some interesting points today. The story with Aaron Bat reveals a world, and the story with Chaim Gold shows you the basic gestalt of the Rebbe. I don't know what Torah Derech Eretz means, but for sure, it means college, Bisman Hazeh. Okay, I have a number of freebies.
What is Derech Eretz Kadmon Torah? What do you
think? If a person is a boor, his Torah becomes worthless. Medav Sein Mensch, that's what it means. Pass this back to Rabbi Rubin. I also want to mention this, I want to discuss for a minute.
When are you starting medical school?
This is. Please call him doctor. This is very interesting. This is going on at the Israel Museum today. There's a display of a Russian artist who has quite a good reputation. Her name is Zoya Tchaikovsky, and it's. This lady had no background, no Yiddishkeit, very little. She's very angry at the absorption of Russians here. And it's very powerful. She shows how they always considered the Russians, either the women are prostitutes, lo aleinu, and the men, all they are musicians. This is powerful. It shows intelligent Israelis and the wild Israelis, but all of them enmity towards the Russians. And there's more, her attitude towards religion, towards the rabbinate, very powerful. So a comment of mine is very upset that the museum is showing this exhibition. I just want to comment that every Aliyah that's come to Israel has suffered, and this is part of the miracle that we survive all these difficulties. But the biggest example is the news that's breaking and will continue to break. Could you imagine they took children away from their parents and gave them up for adoption? You just now have in the news two sisters discovered each other after 60, 70 years. And there's no one to arrest. Shimon Peres is dead. Ben-Gurion is dead. Menachem Parrish is dead. The names of the people involved in this, that they made a decision, cutting the payas, at least the kid remained alive. But they made a decision that a Yemenite kid, take them away, the parents don't know how to raise them. So I got news for you. I can't be angry at the Russians. We have failed to a certain degree, but it's an old story.
Wait a second, I want you to know that they divided among the parties. The Mizrahi got a certain number of children.
I know, that's the education. But
so
here,
in the kibbutz, the children who were adopted, everybody's white except those kids.
But to take kids away from parents, you're saying they cut off payas and fed them chaza. Fine. As terrible as that is, the kid is still alive. Maybe his children came back. Here you're taking kids, they say they sold. I don't know, I don't want to say it. It has to be proven. But one of the charges raised now is they sold kids to America, $5,000 a kid. Could you imagine? Here's a little volume on Rav Kook in relation to building the Beit HaMikdash. It's an interesting volume. Rav Kook, the Chafetz Chaim, a lot of interesting people there. Here's the article from the New York Times that everyone is talking about. Arafat. They thought Arafat was on a plane, and they wanted that. Sharon gave the word, shoot the plane down. Kill everyone on the plane, because we'll kill Arafat. It's a New York Times article. A lot of good research has been quoted in here in every newspaper. Very fascinating. Here's again another article on the Treif banquet. Why the Treif banquet backfired, and no one knows what they're talking about today. Gutzal Lapitin with the Reform Jews nothing is left of Yiddishkeit, what the rabbis have done. That is it, I believe. Yeah. All right. Until we meet again tomorrow, Be'ezrat Hashem, we pick up just where we left off. We should only have Besura Tovet Yeshuot V'nechamot Aleinu Al Chol Yisrael Das V'danya. Okay.
Oh,